don't watch that. Watch this.
I can't believe we've made it to a fucking 100, though. It's so weird.
One step beyond.
Hello, and welcome to this extra special end of season episode of One Pod Beyond. Not only are we looking back at the season just gone, we're also celebrating our 100th episode. Yes, we've had our telegram from Ray Graydon, and the other podcasts in our nursing home have brought us a cake that the staff have cut up into very small pieces for us. I don't think anybody imagined we'd make it this far when we started back in the summer of 2012. The UK was still basking in the glory of the London Olympics. Ashley Hemmings had just scored on his Walsall debut to knock plucky underdogs Brentford out of the League Cup, whatever happened to them. And a fresh-faced David Cameron was just 2 years into his term as Prime Minister. What, as they say, could possibly go wrong? Back to the present day, and quite a lot went wrong in Walsall's last five games of the season. Four defeats, 14 goals conceded, and a slide out of playoff contention and down to 11th was a disappointing conclusion to a season that started poorly, went spectacularly well in December, spectacularly badly in January, and then gave us all false hope with that run of five wins in a row at the end of February. Lots of bones to pick out of our first top half finish in a full season since 2015-16. As usual, I'm joined by Gary and Daz for a full autopsy. I'll come to you first, Gaz, and I want you to give me your good, bad and ugly from 2023-24. Let's start with the good, shall we?
I ain't going to lie, I could spend an entire day just doing this myself. The good, I'm going to start quite vague and ethereal here. We, for a lot of the season, were in a genuine playoff hunt. And I think that is a good thing. We were on the lookout for success. We weren't looking behind us, barring that little stint after Alfreton, for a good portion of, especially from Christmas onwards. We were looking up at the top seven rather than worrying ourselves with the dribble at the bottom. And I think that's a good thing. My bad, and my mate really wants me to say this, so I'm going to be a shill. We had, according to him and his master spreadsheet, we had 15 different centre-back combinations. 15. We used 8 different centre-backs. That's pretty bad. The ugly is married to that. We conceded 73. That's more than most of the division. We know where it needs to change, I think, when we come on to that.
Daz, what makes your selection of seasonal highlights, lowlights and covering your eyes in terror?
Good home form. I think we finished the season as the 6th best team in the division, even with that final disastrous week. We still finished 6th in the division in home form. Set pieces, for the first time in a very, very long time, we look dangerous from set pieces. It's no longer a time-wasting tactic before you give it back to the opposition for a goal kick. Success ratio of youth loans, I think apart from Harvey Griffiths, they just about all worked. The fact the season went to game 46 is in itself measurable progress. It's been a long 12. 2016 is the last time we got to game 46, apart from when we got relegated at Shrewsbury. But, you know, I want to mention Gary Waddick as well. Difficult to do that mentor role, especially when you're on the run we were on earlier on in the season. Sadler didn't need a viable alternative in the dugout next to him. And I think Waddick played that invisible match day man role perfectly. I think he's contributing behind the scenes, but wasn't out in front, putting Sadler under pressure. And I think Waddick deserves kind of a nod. In terms of ugly, it's pretty straightforward. Away form, going behind 18 times from 23 on the road, one clean sheet on the road. And when we did actually take the lead, we failed to win. I mean, Colchester, Gillingham, Crawley and Crewe, to just pull 4 points from those games was really poor. I've also noted Sutton, Milton Keynes, and Wimbledon. I think we shifted 14 goals for one in reply. And finally, and I guess we're going to come on to this because we always do, the way we handled Danny Johnson. You know, it's been an absolute waste of talent, goals, and money. You know, we'll probably discuss it in depth later, but we signed him and haven't used him. And finally, just two more that just come to mind. We conceded 21 goals in the month between Milton Keynes and Wimbledon. It was 30 days or 29 days worth of football. We conceded 21 goals at a point where we were supposedly serious about making the playoffs, and the two things don't get together. And injuries, our inability to keep players on the pitch has kind of hampered us throughout the season, and it's partly the reason why Gazzi's 15 centre-half combo is so obvious.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty comprehensive list there, Daz. You've ticked off all the ones that that I was going to mention. So let's look at the manager. Matt Sadler went through his fair share of ups and downs last season, and by all accounts came, you know, pretty close to being triggered by Trivella around the time of the Alfreton games. But ahead of the Wimbledon game, he was awarded a new contract, although interesting that the length wasn't disclosed. Daz, was that new contract deserved?
I thought Michael Flynn was on a performance-related deal last year, which is why he persisted, I think, so long with players who had continually failed him. Similarly, I fancy Sadler has triggered some kind of contract update this year. Does he deserve it? More likely than not. I do get the constructive criticisms. I do, you know, I've already just mentioned Johnson, and the inability to integrate him is problematic. I don't get the PE teacher and the cheap option stuff, but yes, I think in taking us to game 46, he deserves credit and something viable to take from it. And the truth, with using hindsight, the next 6 months will tell us if it was the right decision or not.
Gaz, what do you think the priorities for the next 6 months are for Sadler if he's to prove that this is a contract that he deserves?
I think there's three things he's got to hit in the summer to trigger some Alan Pardew-esque decade-long contract of doom. I think we've all already sorted this, he's the DJ saga. He's got to get on top of that and what he's doing, because it's giving him a stick to be beaten with. And if he doesn't hit the ground running with or without DJ, it's a stick that will be used, and frequently and quickly. I think more importantly than that, because I don't think scoring goals is the problem, it's conceding goals. It's tuning up his defence, defending from wide and defending from set pieces. We do score a lot from set pieces, but we do concede a decent wedge from them as well. Defending from wide. I mean, Wimbledon was an absolute microcosm of it. I think all five of them were from crosses from out wide, and it killed me. I'm glad I was half cut when I saw you, Tom. Let's just put it like that. If I'm being picky, this is on my Attrica wish list. He's a bit more proactive in games to change. He can react well, like with the Swindon game. You know, he had to go for it, made the changes, made the play available to his players to do what they needed to do. I think he just needs to be a bit more proactive. You tend to see him react to a lot of changes, react to a lot of game states. So him being able to see a game not going our way, and then making that little tweak that, I'd say probably the best manager down here that we've had for that is probably Clark. It's those things that he needs to do. So defending all across the pitch, DJ saga, being proactive in his changes and his tweaks.
Daz, would you add anything to that?
Very little. I would like to see a bit of surgery in the back three, because I think we've used so many players and we've leaked all the way through And for me, it's something probably systemic that needs a look at. Wing backs, we don't get enough quality into the front two, and quite frankly, they both leave too many holes behind them. So do some work with the wing backs, whether that's new ones or improving the output of them.
So, Gaz, what do you think he needs to do next season for it to be considered another improvement? Is it top seven or bust?
Yeah, unless there's some bank of excuses that he can jump into, like a massive injury crisis or something like that. Yeah, I do think it's top seven. We've lost three out of the top five budgets in Mansfield, Stockport and Wrexham. We've got Bromley and Chesterfield coming up who aren't as strong as Disney on Ice and Stockport. It's generally going to be a weaker division because of the loss of those teams. I think it is a good top seven challenge. And I don't mind if we don't get top three, but I think he's got to be more than around that top seven. I think he's got to hit the ground running, because I think if he waits until Christmas to make the charge, there'll already be knives out.
It's interesting. I listened back to the pre-season pod to check our terrible predictions, more on which later, which will be fun. Actually, it's genuinely quite exciting, as a more exciting than our bid for the top seven, to be fair. It goes right down to the wire, let me tell you. But anyway, little trailer for later. But yeah, in terms of Sadler, we were talking about League Two, and we all said it looked like the toughest League Two pretty much ever, certainly since we'd been down here. This time with the likes of Stockport, Notts County, we knew Wrexham would be strong, we knew Mansfield would be strong, MK Dons came down. So, I mean, Sadler deserves a bit of credit, doesn't he, Daz, for getting us our higher finish in the toughest division for a while. But at the same time, it's all about context, isn't it? Because the context was we had a really good chance of getting in the top seven, certainly the best since we've been down here, and we kind of blew it, didn't we?
Yeah, I think that everything you mentioned is right. There's Notts County, we expected to be stronger than they eventually ended up. But top seven probably needs to be the aim. I think after Doncaster, we've dropped five places in the months after Doncaster. And I think with Notts County not performing, I think that the top three or four were probably beyond us because of the spending. But that middle section, we saw all season, we were all very much a muchness, much of a muchness. And 11th was probably the minimum that we can look back and smile at. You know, we should have been a little bit higher, and the tops 6th and 7th were achievable for us.
Yeah, again, it comes down to consistency, doesn't it? I'm going to wheel out my favourite stat of the season now, which I don't think I've seen anyone else use, and I'm quite proud of this one. So Walsall were the only team in League Two to beat every one of the top three. So Stockport, Wrexham and Mansfield. We were also the only team in League Two to fail to beat one of the bottom two. So Sutton and Forest Green. And that is absolutely classic Walsall, isn't it? But it does point to the lack of consistency. Picking up points against the teams you would expect to pick points up against, and then overachieving against teams when you can get yourself up for, you know, a game at Bescot against a Wrexham or a Stockport or a Mansfield. But again, it comes back to that away form, doesn't it? All of those three games against the top three were at home. And on the road, it was a story of conceding far too many and not seizing the opportunity. Let's look at the players now. Hutch won Supporters Player of the Season, while Jackson Smith was Young Player. Brandon Comley picked up Players Player. Gary, is that about right? Or were there any other serious contenders, do you think?
No, I think that fell pretty well, to be honest. I don't think there's anyone who put themselves into the positions, you know, nobody's going to beat 15 goals and 12 assists from Hutchinson's Player of the Season. the players are going to recognise that Conley's the glue that helps keep them together a bit. And Jackson Smith-Cook came in, and Dazu went to the Barrow match he came in for after looking really shaky in the weeks beforehand, and actually didn't play badly. He took his chance after that. So I can't complain with the big three individual awards from the club. It's pretty cut and dry, I think, anyway.
I guess my only query would be over what the sort of criteria for young player is. Because if you think that Taylor Allen is only about 15 months older than Jackson Smith, I think he's 23, Smith's 22. I think depending on the criteria, there's a good chat for Taylor Allen as young player of the season. Daz, what are your views on player of the season?
On young player of the season, the fact that Freddie Draper couldn't be nominated because he moved on is ridiculous to me. Freddie Draper was probably the young player of the season. And we can talk about Smith, but they played the same kind of cross-section of games. So for me, Freddie Draper was young player of the season. Hutch, absolutely. Double figures, goals and assists. When his form dipped, so did ours. I actually wrote a note that I think only him and Liam Gordon were the only two automatic selections for the entire 40 weeks of the season. I think Hutch was substitute against Notts County off the top of my head, but it was the only time he was available when he didn't start. I think the players can see what Comley brings. Got no argument with any of those.
Let's look at the retained and released situation then. Obviously, we've not had confirmation from the club. It will almost certainly come out as I'm editing this, as usually happens. But let's take a look at the situation in terms of players who are out of contract. So there are 11 players out of contract in the summer. That's Jackson Smith, Owen Evans, Joe Folks, Rollin Meniesse, Joe Riley and Jamil Matt, plus Harry Williams, Taylor Allen, Tom Knowles, Aramidi Ote and Douglas James Taylor all have the option of a further year at the club's discretion. So I'm going to go through those players now, and I want you to tell me whether you would keep or release them. So, Daz, I'll go with you first. Jackson Smith?
Try and keep.
Evans?
I think he'll be gone, but I would offer him something, but I think he'll be gone.
Folks?
Yes.
Meniesse?
I think his time's up.
I think I know the answer to this one, but Joe Riley?
Yeah, same.
And possibly the most interesting one of the ones who are out of contract and haven't got any options, Jamil Matt?
I think I've seen enough from Matt in the 6 months he's been fit to try and do something. But for me, you can't build anything that you're going to build around a player that plays 60 minutes a week if you're lucky. I'd like to find a way of doing a deal because I think he's the glue that keeps everything together. But I'm not pushing the boat out.
Gaz, I'll ask you the same list of players before we go on to the ones who've got a year at the club's discretion. So the goalkeepers first, Jackson Smith.
Keep.
Owen Evans.
It's a shame for him, but I think he's in the Liam Roberts situation. He's gone.
Joe Folks.
Keep.
Rollin Meniesse. Riley.
Same.
And what about Matt?
At Walsall, we are likely to play 55 games a season. I think if Matt can get properly fit and play 90 minutes for 35 of those, I think you get him in. I think he's one of those where, I think Daz said it, he's the glue that can keep us together. If you can keep him in decent nick for the majority of games, keep him. If you can't, if you think you can't, you've got to weigh up that cost-benefit thing with the amount of money you're applying into him. So, yeah, I think I would, but I'd be erring towards pay-as-you-play. It depends. Well, obviously, I don't know the chap. I don't know what they're going to do for him, but something where it's, you're not just playing him a wage to sit on the sideline.
Yeah, I mean, is there value in offering him some sort of coaching role, potentially, if that's a road he wants to go down? I mean, given what we always say about him being the connection between Sadler and the players, and, as you say, the glue that holds stuff together, clearly I think the players, you know, have a massive amount of respect for him, and so does Sadler. So I guess there'd be a bit of crossover with Darren Byfield being the sort of striker's coach at the moment. But yeah, I wonder if there's a sort of a bit of a hybrid role for him potentially. Could be something worth looking at. I'll stay with you, Gaz, as we look at the players who we can trigger an extra year for. So Harry Williams?
I think I would. I think there's probably enough there from what we've seen of him taking out Cook. And, you know, he's been at Leicester. He's been with England under 16s, was it, or something. There's pedigree there. I think there's enough to offer him something to see. And his season's been curtailed by injury coming from non-league to here. So, yeah, I think he deserves a go.
Taylor Arnold?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the weird thing. Four months ago, I think at least two out of three of us released him. But yeah, I would definitely keep him, and he would be centre back. None of this midfield left wing back kind of thing. He would be a left centre back.
Here's an interesting one that will divide opinion. Tom Knowles.
I don't know. He's the only one where I've said I don't know. I don't think he's good enough to be right wing back defensively. It's improved a bit through the season, but I'm not sure. He's the only one where I wouldn't be unhappy to see him back. If you loaned in another Liam Bennett kind of player instead of Knowles, then I wouldn't be unhappy there either. So he's truly the only one where I'm unsure.
Ote?
I think unless we're playing with a proper winger, he's gone.
And finally, Douglas James-Taylor.
We've had him for 2 years. His effort can't be questioned, however his talent can. And I hoped he'd come good around the new year. He scored at Grimsby, scored in the Stockport game. He's just not had the chances. He's just not taken the chances, pardon me. And he could be a player that will do well somewhere else, but I think 2 years is long enough for the test out.
Daz, quickly, I'll go through them with you as well. So let's start with Harry Williams.
Yeah, I think it's worth a go.
The Canuck Cannavaro.
Absolutely, just for being Canuck.
Controversies, Tom Knowles.
I would, but for a different reason. I think we're going to lose Hutch in the summer, and I would trigger that contract in case we couldn't get anybody else.
That's not a bad shade, actually.
I think there's a role for him to play, but I'd be looking to update my wing back.
Ote?
I think you have to say goodbye. It hasn't worked. I think he's been fit for weeks and not even made the bench, which kind of tells you where we are.
And finally, Douglas James-Taylor.
Regrettably, I think I would let it go. I don't think we can hang on much longer. I think I would. There's a small chance that he could come back and sting us, but I think it's time to move on.
Douglas James-Taylor and I will always have that moment after the win at Grimsby where I wound down my window and shouted up the Saddlers at him, and he looked terrified as he crossed the road with 24 bottles of Budweiser to take back to the team coach. So if for nothing else, thanks for that, Dougie. And sorry you looked so terrified. I'm going to go to a question we've kind of sort of touched on, but let's go into it into a bit more depth. So I think one of the big questions this summer is whether Danny Johnson starts next season as a Saddler. He has got another year left on his contract, but do we think he sees it out, or is he on his way? And if he does go, can we see us getting a fee for him from someone, or is it more likely to be a sort of mutual termination given the likely wages that he's on and the fact he really doesn't appear to fit into Saddler's system or plans? Daz, do you think Danny Johnson starts next season in a red shirt?
No, is the fastest answer. Before I start, I think it's worth noting the way that Johnson has behaved. I think he's behaved impeccably. He's never played up, or he's never played up outwardly, and he deserves credit for that. I think Gaz rightly alluded earlier to he's become a stick with which to beat Saddler with. The distraction has been massive, and it's been a waste of a significant salary. Can't see Saddler changing what he wants. I don't think Johnson is able and willing to change into what Saddler wants. So for me, pick the opportune moment, get the best deal we can, and wish him well. You know, right player, right club, just the wrong time.
Gary, what are your views on Danny Johnson's future?
I feel quite sad after hearing that, to be honest. It's an hard one. If you were a manager in League Two and asked your chairman for a transfer fee to buy Danny Johnson, if he was in any tune of the league, he would probably laugh you out of the room and potentially give you a written warning. After the season he's had, no one's going to pay a fee for him. So that only leaves the mutual termination, pay some of your contract kind of thing going on. And unless there's a team that can do that, I think he will be here. But it depends how it works. I think if he is here, everyone has got to be given a clean slate. Like Saddler with him, DJ with Saddler. Everyone's got to start from year zero. Forget what he did under Flynn. Forget last season. It's got to be this season and that's it. I'm going around the houses to say I don't really bloody know, because I can't see anyone coming to buy him. And I can't see us freeing up that much money to release him. I still think he can do a job. That's the thing. I'm very much a DJ truther.
Yeah, I'm not sure we can have another season where that much of the budget.
No, we can't at all.
Sitting on the bench.
I agree. I totally agree. We can't have that much sitting on the bench. So they either need to patch it up or fuck it off.
I mean, is it as simple, Daz? I mean, we don't know, do we, is the simple answer. We don't know what's gone on. As you say, he's conducted himself pretty well, but has clearly been cheesed off that he's not been playing. You can see it in his body language, you know, on the pitch occasionally when he's scored. Is it simply that his lack of pressing up front is anathema to what Saddler wants from his team?
Every time I've seen, I'd have him in my team every week for what it's worth, because I don't think you can ignore what he does. Or the eye for goal that he's got. He'd be in my team every week. But every time he's played this season, after the first kind of few games, and when he got injured or he Draper took over, he's looked lost, to be brutally honest. I thought his goal a couple of weeks ago was every reason why you'd want him in the team. But he's looked lost. Absolutely lost. It's like it just doesn't work. Just one bit of a stat type thing. Richard Hall, who's a good friend of mine, sent me a chat a while ago and pointed out how many times he'd been substitute in his career. He's 189 starts and 92 substitute appearances, suggesting that Saddler isn't the only manager who hasn't quite trusted him as much as he should. I don't know what the problem is. I don't know why we can't adapt to get him into the team, but it's just too much of a distraction and too much of a budget drain to have somebody not contributing.
No, I was just going to jump in. Like at the start of the season, he had the baby born that was apparently ill. His granddad apparently died as well. So he's not personally had the best run into the season either. So as the Pod's DJ truther, I will kind of give it that as well. Like he's not had the best entry into a season either. But I do agree with what everyone's saying about you can't keep that kind of wage on the bench as well. Like I'm not saying it's DJ at all costs, but you know there are things as well.
We know from his time at Mansfield that Clough was another manager, you know, vastly more experienced than Saddler, who seemed to have the same kind of issues of not trusting him to start games for him, brought him back last season, which transparently was because they were worried about us potentially shooting up the table because he didn't play him then either, you know. So it'd be interesting to see what happens at his next club and, you know, whether he, with an extended run in the team, he can sort of find his feet again. Let's take a last look back at 23-24 before we get into our terrible predictions. I'm going to ask you about your highlight from the season, your highlight and your low point from the season. I'll start with you, Gaz. What was your highlight from last season?
Well, there's a few that you could probably see as like the traditional highlights. Weirdly, I am going to go with crew at home on Boxing Day. One, it's beating crew. Always good. Two, they're a playoff team, so they're actually a good team, horribly to say. But we beat them so handily and so routinely that it shows that on our game, this Walsall team can actually do those normal things well. There's obviously higher scoring wins. There's more exciting wins from fans' point of view. But I think that weird banality of just beating crew, it was like, oh, crew are coming. We haven't beat them at home for ages. Actually, we'll just turn them over and give them absolutely fuck all. And I think that was a real highlight for me. It was like, this is what a Walsall team should be doing routinely. And that was my highlight.
Daz, bring some extra sunshine with your own personal highlight.
Gaz, I love that, by the way. I absolutely adored that. At Notts County from the second half, and particularly the way we killed the clock. I think he played 6 minutes over at Notts County, and we sat in the corner playing that kind of protect the ball at all costs for about five of the 6 minutes. I've also got the festive double, smashing crew at home, then sending FC Disneyland packing 3 days later. If the crew one was satisfying, the twatting of Wrexham, if I'm allowed to say that, was even better. A good friend of mine, Liam, turned round when we scored the third goal against Wrexham and said, put that in your documentary and smoke it. And there was probably a swear word or two in Liam's version as well, but he kind of summed up the magic. And then I called it a festive double. It was actually a festive treble, weren't it, with Grimsby?
I'll bring my ray of sunshine in terms of my highlight of the season. And considering we were pretty poor away from home, it is two away games for me. Grimsby away, 6-1, one of those, you know, games you turn up more in hope than expectation and something a little bit magical happens. So that was nice. And then the second one was Harrogate away, where just for a moment, anything seemed possible. You know, we climbed, I don't know how many places we climbed that day. It was a lot. And suddenly we were on the fringes of the playoffs. We'd kept a clean sheet away from home. That was the last time, I think, wasn't it? And the only time away from home. It we soaked up a lot of pressure, and then we were just by far the better team in the second half. And we made it look a little bit easy. And as I say, everything seemed possible. But we are going to have to turn to some negative thoughts now, Gary. So what was your low point of 23-24?
Between two, there's Newport at home, where they gave us an absolute shagging. And then there's Notts County at home, where it was like, oh God, this is crumbling down. It was grim. That felt grim. That first minute or two where Langstaff had been given basically the freedom of pleck to knob it in, that was fucking horrible. On a like a longer term note of doom, because I don't make it to as many away games as I usually did back in the day, the biggest low light for me was whether I was out with the kid, the wife, out with friends at the pub, I'd inevitably by about 3:30 get a notification going, Walsall have conceded. And it was always like, oh God, the inevitability of conceding away just eats at you all through the season. And that was probably my longer term low light compared to the single matches of shite, occasional shite.
Daz, your low point?
Going to drop a couple in. Barrow was a chastising experience. Alfreton, stoppage time was already up. We got possession on our 18-yard line. In my head, I'm thinking, keep the ball, kind of wait for the referee to blow time, and let's finish it off at Bescott. At exactly that point, I think it was McKenzie who just knocked it completely out of play, and we had to defend another of them throwing bombs that Alfreton were putting in, and that was a genuine low light. My son lives abroad, and one of the things I genuinely miss is going to football with him. I only managed to get to one game with him this season, which was Sutton away. His boss sent him a text after about 20 minutes complaining he couldn't concentrate on the game he was trying to listen to, because Soccer Saturday kept going back for Sutton goal updates. And I think that's as shambolic as anything I've ever seen. And that includes Halifax in the 90s.
Ouch. For me, I think having already put it down as one of the high points, I'm also going to put Grimsby down as my low point of the season, because I was really looking forward to the fish and chips on Cleethorpe Seafront, and I'm afraid they were disappointing. So, you know, I've heard a lot about the fish and chips at Grimsby. Maybe I just went to the wrong place, but for me, not good. Just before we wrap up last season with our predictions, let's have a quick word about how Trevella are doing. It's something we sort of periodically check in with. How do we feel our American overlords have done so far, Gary?
Second season they've been here now. I think infrastructure-wise, they haven't got that much wrong. Obviously, Dazzy's going to bring up Peasant Gates in a minute. But realistically, apart from that, infrastructure-wise, I don't think they've got much wrong. They've got the incremental progress thing kind of nailed. It depends how long we are in this division for, I guess. But I was talking to my mate on the No Foul launch, the Notts County game, was he? And he was saying how if an away fan came into the locker at that point, they'd be like, oh, crow, it's a bit like a proper club. You know what I mean? Like it feels like, and okay, we missed out on playoffs, probably by, you know, partially bottling it. But actually, we're looking more like a proper club doing proper club things. The only thing that needs to catch up now is the stuff on the pitch, really. And as long as that catches up in decent nick, they're doing all right, I think. Again, caveated with what me and you usually say, Tom, is they're a venture capitalist company. They are going to want return on investment, and how much and when. There you go.
Daz, how's Trevella's incremental progress going?
Gary's touched on quite a few of my points. I think the locker fab facility, I think it was built to the right standard rather than the lowest budget we could get away with and the cheapest specification. The NOFO launch was as professional as anything I've seen at the football club in terms of that kind of stuff. Neither would have happened anywhere as well under the reign of our biggest fan. We're also a year and a half closer to being mortgage and rent free. And we don't know how long the mortgage is, and we whether it's 10 years, 15 years, whatever, but we're a year closer to not having to pay mortgage and having to being able to invest that in the team. That's got to be progress. It's impossible not to mention that things are getting a little bit expensive. But in truth, I don't mind paying an extra quid if it goes into improving the club. I don't think they've finished yet. I think there's more development to be done. Like you say, the venture capitalists, they're here for a return. I don't think they're done yet. I think we'll see more.
Having started the show by talking about the good, the bad and the ugly, it's now time to get on to the ugly, uglier and Luke Chadwick as we delve back into our pre-season predictions. How did we do? This is me doing a big long monologue, and Daz and Gary horrified at some of the choices they made that they've forgotten about. Because I'd certainly forgotten about some of my terrible ones.
I've forgotten about mine. I love this.
In the intervening 9 months,
I haven't forgotten mine, and I'm duly embarrassed already.
So let's start with our predictions for the top three. Daz did the best of us. He picked Stockport and Wrexham. His third choice was Notts County, as with the rest of us. I think we all had Notts County in the top three, and they were looking pretty good, let's be honest, for a good part of the season, and then obviously had their horrendous drop off. Gaz went out on a limb and said that Stockport would finish top, and he was right. He also had Gillingham and Notts County as his others in the top three, who fared less well in terms of the playoff places. We should do me, shouldn't we? So I was trying to avoid revealing that I picked Salford to finish in the top three, which was particularly minging. I did have Stockport and also Notts County, so that sunk a few of us. And then in terms of the playoffs, Daz also predicted a good season for Salford. He had them in the playoffs. Also Gillingham. He did get a point for predicting that MK Dons would finish in the playoffs. Big shout out for Daz for his best prediction. His dark horse relegated Sutton.
I remember that there.
Yep.
Daz had down to finish in the top seven. Gary fared a bit better. He had Wrexham in the playoffs, not in the top three. He also had Mansfield in the playoffs. Salford, and the only one of the three of us to predict Doncaster for a top seven finish. So
I thought I'd done that last season.
Well done, Gaz. Picked for the playoffs Wrexham, Mansfield, Gillingham and MK Dons. So not bad. MK Dons was spot on. Wrexham and Mansfield obviously finished higher in the top three. And then relegation. Daz was the only one of us to pick one of the relegated teams. He got Forest Green correct. Very good to predict them going down for two seasons in a row. All three of us picked Crawley to get relegated, like a lot of wiser pundits than us. They did have that look of the basket case about them. And I think it's tribute to Scott Lindsay at Crawley. He's done a phenomenal job to get them anywhere near the top seven, never mind looking like they could actually cause a bit of an upset against MK Dons. Me and Gaz, as I say, we picked Crawley. Gaz had Newport to go down, which actually wasn't a bad shout. They finished the season absolutely terribly. And I picked Morecambe, who were actually all right for much of the season. Dark horses, Daz picked two, but we're going with Sutton. We're not accepting his second answer of Barrow because they did all right. I picked Grimsby, which was not good. So well done to Gaz for picking Donny as his dark horse for the season, which was by far the best effort from any of us. We all picked Bradford for our overrated team. And for a lot of the season, that looked like it was going to come true before they had a bit of a late burst. But thankfully, they still didn't manage to get into the top seven. So nobody gets a point there because we all picked exactly the same team. We did the same for the top scorer. We all picked Langstaff. We were all right. So we all get a point for that.
This is sounding remarkably like cogent thinking. This is weird. Like apart from Dazzy Sutton, nothing sounding too terrible.
So the current scores, with a point for getting it right and half a point for getting your team in the top seven for the promotion and playoff spots. I've currently got 4 points. Gary's currently got 5 points. And Daz currently has 5 points. So it's going to come down to where we predicted Walsall to come in the season, which is often the tiebreaker.
Daz, this is the bit now where Tom just wins. I have no idea what he picked, but this is how it goes.
Even though it's mathematically impossible.
Yeah, absolutely.
From memory, I think we were all really close to one another.
Yeah, I think we were
very close together. So Gary had us finishing 13th. I had us finishing 12th. And Daz had us finishing 11th.
Oh,
absolutely spot on. So with that prediction, Daz is last season's champion. So in your debut season, what a return that is.
There you go. It's a miracle.
Makes up for your slightly disappointing performance on the yellow ribbon Christmas quiz, which we won't mention.
It's the man who walks in with Sutton as a dark horse, walk away the winner. Exactly.
Sutton as a dark horse and pineapple in Bolognese. What can you say?
That's your lasting legacy, Daz.
Yeah.
So congratulations.
Jesus, sweat.
So one more thing to do before we move on to listener questions, and that is to sum up the season in a song. We always do this as a bit of fun at the end of every season. What song sums up the 23-24 season for you, Daz?
Defensively, Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine, anytime, any place, anywhere, which would sum up our habit of conceding away from home. And offensively, the Smiths, I started something I couldn't finish, which kind of sums up how many chances we missed in the second half of the season. I started something, forced you to a zone,
and you were clearly never meant to go. Very good. Gaz?
Mine's more down to every man, woman, child, dog, cat and everyone else having a pop whenever they're fancy at Sadler, even though he had actually done the best of the jobs down here since relegation. And I think that it sums up by the line, all I want is a little peace and quiet. The Rifles, peace and quiet. All I want is a little peace and quiet.
Very good. And for me, this song I chose because it kind of sums up the way this season has still left people on the fence about Sadler, despite it being our highest finish since 15-16, highest number of goals scored, highest number of wins, etc., etc. Still a lot of uncertainty about Sadler. So I think the only way he satisfies them and Trivella next season is with a top seven finish. So I'm going to choose Seven Ways to Love by Cola Boy because he has seven ways to satisfy people, which is finishing in the top seven next season. It also has my favourite ever xylophone solo, which is another good reason for choosing it. But in a slightly ominous portent, Seven Ways to Love by Cola Boy only reached a high position of number eight. So let's hope Matt Sadler can go at least one better next season.
The xylophone solo is so new.
Right, I think we better move on to listener questions, Gareth.
We all do, yes. Are we doing football first or food first?
Let's do football first.
Oh, God. All right, then. Let's close out the season. Right. We are on our 100th episode. It is absolutely mad that a little message from Tom going, do you fancy talking on this podcast, turned into 12 years of this. 12 years of talking this shit. Right. Well, me talking shit and you lot talking quite decently and openly about stuff. But me just adding the colour. Dan, friend of the pod, he has asked, since August 2012, that's a long time, even my missus was surprised and she married me. Right. Since August 2012, who are the 10 best and the 10 worst players within those 100 podcasts? Daz, I'll go with you first.
Just random order. Adam Chambers. Well, I don't think we've ever replaced him. Rico Henry. Jamie Patterson, Tom Bradshaw, Romain Sawyers, who I think we should have a dabble at in the summer. Andy Butler, not necessarily the best player, but somebody that was front and centre of the club coming back to, or the team coming back together. Jason Dimitriou, Aaron Odzuma, George Evans, even though his spell was brief, he's as good as anything we saw in the last decade, I think. And I've got Elijah Adebayo as well.
Tom, what about your 10 best?
Yeah, I think there's going to be quite a bit of crossover here. Whereas the terrible players, you've got a lot more to choose from, haven't you? So fertile ground. But yeah, the classics, the classic lineup, Sawyers, Bradshaw, Henry, Patterson, Butler, Chambers, George Evans, I agree with Daz, Oz Toomer, Jason McCarthy, Black Country Jace Mark II, the high point of the come down from the 15-16 season, the 16-17 season. And then finally, Liam Bennett, who, you know, you could pick quite a few lone players, but Bennett was phenomenal, I thought.
Daz has got six of mine, and Tom, you've got seven. So I went in no particular order. Bradshaw, Sawyers, Patterson, Henry, which we've all got. Chambers, which we've all got. You know I'm a bastard for a marauder. So I've got McCarthy, Bennett and Dimitriou. I've got all the Black Country Jaces. I've also got Etheridge because he looked far and away a great goalkeeper. The best of the good goalkeepers that we've had in our 12 years, I would say. My out there one is Craig Westcar. A bit of a journeyman striker, but actually under Smith got really consistent. And I think the way he ran the game against Wolves away at their place, he was an absolute thorn in players' sides. Just absolutely, you know, great kind of, he was a good mix of a 10 and a 9. And I thought actually he was exceptional. Looking back, I think through hindsight more than anything, I thought he was pretty good. Now, lads, it's time for the fun part. Your 10 worst. Now, Daz, you said this was the Flynn Clark Award. The Flynn Clark Award. So I'm guessing Flynn Clark might turn up somewhere, or it might be like ubiquitous, and we call this, and then you get another 10 on top. Because I got to about 15 and then had to start crossing out. So, Tom, I'll give you your worst 10.
Okay, the worst 10 over the last 12 years. Russell Martin, Ash Taylor, Rory Gaffney, we had to engineer a mid-season transfer to Ireland to get rid of him because there was about to be a riot. He was so bad. Gary Liddle, firm favourite, pod favourite, possibly named more than any other player over the last sort of two or three years. Derek Osseyor, Christian Bielik, the player who never existed. A couple of slightly controversial ones in terms of what we thought we were getting and what we actually got. Joss Labadie, I'm going to put in there. And also Joe Riley. Sorry, Joe. Not absolutely terrible, but not what we thought we were getting. And probably took up a decent chunk of the budget at the same time. I'm going to mention Makris again simply because of what he represented. You know, the 36-year-old transfer record of Buckley, which we thought we'd never break, and then broke to bring him in. And coincidentally, one goal in 35 games adds up to 36 as well. So, yeah, not the best signing. And then I've got two players who this is, I couldn't decide between these for the 10th spot. Sort of just sums up how many of our strikers you can sort of look down a list and think, I have no recollection of them. And then you look down and see they scored like either no goals or one goal or two goals. So Troy Hewitt, 30 games, one goal in the Tin Pot Paint Pot Trophy. And Ashley Grimes, 36 appearances, two goals. I think judging by the... I mean, I'd completely forgotten Hewitt. So judging by the visceral reaction from you, Gary, maybe Ashley Grimes just makes it in.
Ashley Grimes, I would put in your 10 way over Troy Hewitt because that one goal was an absolute fucking scorcher against the Dogheads away in the Tin Pot.
It was.
It was absolutely fantastic. I don't think I've celebrated a Tin Pot Cup goal like that till the Preston game.
Mm.
So actually, I'll keep Troy Hewitt as Warsaw legend, and Ashley Grimes can get the fuck in that list.
I'm glad we've got that sorted.
Thank you, Daz.
I'm not keen on singling out players who at least tried, and I think most of those players you mentioned. Troyed. I'd add Devante Rodney. I'll take your Hewitt and add Devante Rodney too. But when I kind of sidestepped it and went for a 10 who should have been better than they were, and I genuinely just ended up disliking them. So this is a bit of spleen vented here. Luke Leahy, Morgan Ferrier. Hindsight tells me the punch up they had at Oxford, we should have just let them get on with it and just get it all out of the way. Andy Cook, Jack Fizzwater, David Groff, Otis Khan, Zeli Ishmael, Ashton Taylor, Danny Guthrie, and finally Matt Jarvis. I think almost all of them joined us out of convenience rather than actually wanting to do anything here, and rather than go for for the very poorest talent, I've gone for the players I think kind of who fouled us the most.
The only one to be in all three lists is Ashton Taylor. He's the Flynn Clark God Squad member. I've got the Prince Osayor, but I'll mention the ones who haven't been named. Justin Scheibe, Michael Ngu, and I'm surprised this didn't come up, Kevin Toner. I've also got Nathan Sheeran, who is a complete no mark of a player. I'll join in on Tom's side. Me and you, Tom, we will go and fight the lads from Yellow Wall, Yellow Ribbon. We'll fight them all because I'm having Joe Riley as well. Given to us as the next coming of Beckenbauer, from the likes, actually, bag of shite. He's done nothing, has he? He's done nothing. And again, I'll caveat this with, they are all trying to make their way in football. I hope they have a good career. I hope they're all right. I wish them no ill health. Apart from Christian Bielik, who I wouldn't know who he was if he was hanging out the back of the wife, I will go to my grave by saying that man does not exist. He could come up and cut me tongue out. I don't believe in you. I believe in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy more, and I'll drop the £2 behind the babby's head. I feel like I'm getting ranty now, actually. But the Flynn Clark Award, the ultimate Flynn Clark Award, must go to Ashton Taylor.
Motion carried.
Right. Final question. Ollie, friend of the pod, good lad. What is the best beige British buffet item? He's talking your nan's 80th that's been put on by the social club. Your item has to be beige, Tom.
I've got three beige items. I'm going to start with some you would almost always get. And then a third, which I would hope to see, and I would get stuck right into. So mini pork pies, obviously the classic staple of the beige buffet. Chicken skewers, a bit of protein. Obviously, you know, that's a high value item, so you can't be taking too many, but you'd hope to sneak a couple maybe under something else. But my absolute go-to on the beige buffet is the samosa. If it's got a samosa on the beige buffet, I'm there. I'm all over it. Don't get it ever confused with its evil counterpart, the spring roll. Not a fan of the spring roll. Don't like spring rolls. Pointless food. But I love a samosa.
I'd eat samosas till the cows come out. Oh, I didn't think you'd be a hater of the spring roll. My wife and you are going to come to blows, I reckon. She bloody loves a spring roll. Oh, it's a solid start, though. Daz?
The Working Men's Club, Social Club, has moved on a bit since the Scotch egg, being the pinnacle of culinary extravagance in the 70s and 80s. The samosa with a mango chutney dip is where your nan's 80th birthday party peaks for me. I nearly went for satay chicken, and I kind of wish I had now Tom had gone for samosa. Satay chicken runs it close, but for me, the samosa ticks every box.
It's a fair one. I can't argue. Now, I kind of thought to me, oh, no. My nana definitely say a samosa was a little too ethnic for it, a little too spicy. You know what I mean? She had like one taste, but I reckon my nan did. Right, so I was thinking from her point of view. And I think the king of the beige buffet, you've got Scotch eggs, fantastic things. I've seen you nail a Scotch egg before, Tom. It was like watching God come down to earth. Right. I love a samosas. Argan's in Karma, absolute God level samosas. Absolutely fantastic. But I'm going to go with the sausage roll. Right. I have a checkered past with a pork pie. I don't like the jelly in it. I don't like the jelly. So I would normally go for a pork pie. And I have nothing really against pork pies now. I've grown up and got past my jelly weirdness. But the sausage roll, it's a bit of meat wrapped in a bit of pastry. And going against Tom's satay, actually, you can put quite a few on there if you need to. And the best thing is, if you've got a cob, stick a couple of sausage rolls in the cob as well. Lovely bit of texture for it. So I'm going to go with sausage roll as my peak beige buffet. I think that'll be... But I think between us, we've got a lovely bit of beige.
I've got a question for you, Gary. When I was doing my buffet research, I stumbled across something called buff etiquette. The etiquette around the buffets in a magazine, in a style magazine, funnily enough. And they had quite a few slightly strange rules that I think you might take issue with, because they seem slightly strange to me. So rule number one was you have to wait 5 minutes once the buffet's put out before getting stuck into the buffet. Apparently that is the polite length of time before you can go up and start filling your plate. So I'd like to get your views on that.
Absolute bullshit. You're not the first person. That's the only thing. You're not the first person. As soon as someone goes up, it doesn't matter what party, right? It could be a little old dear going up. It could be one of the lads who are off their face. As soon as someone goes up, open season.
The floodgates are open.
Yeah. Once one goes, everyone goes.
Rule number two, it is bad manners to go up more than twice. What's the most you've ever been up?
Oh, Thomas. I think I've probably gone up about five or six times. I mean, working in a school, I get to go on courses, and sometimes they're catered. So, like, I tend to fill my boots. Like, as long as you're not sleeping in the second half of the day, you're all right, really. I think I have been up to one buffet six times, but it was a really good buffet. And realistically, they don't want to take the food home, so you eat it there and it's all right. As long as someone's not coming back with half a chicken wing or something, you know, I'm not going to go up a lot of times in the first bit. I'm going to have a couple of plates first and then stretch it over the evening. I'm not going to do six Blitzkrieg plates and just sit at my table hoarding. That's wrong. That's rude. But, you know, you go up and you think, oh, I'll have a few sausage rolls, cocktail sausage. Yeah, go up. That's fine. Fuck them.
And finally, buff etiquette rule number three. Apparently, it's frowned upon to send other people up for you. So, Gary, have you ever sent the wife up? Have you sent the child up?
It's probably the reason why I had a child. Again, your rule's absolute bullshit. My mate's wedding was a hog roast, but it had other bits as well for veggies and people who didn't want to eat pork. It was all fair enough. But I made sure my wife does not like roast pork. She's a bit of a freak, right? I love her, but she's a bit of a freak. So I sent her up, and she got her bap of something else. But I definitely sent her up for a pork bap as well. So I ended up with two, because who doesn't want two big fat pork baps with applesauce and gravy and stuff, you know? Yeah, you can send people up as long as you're not breaking the rules set in number two's explanation, as long as you're not hoarding food and going mad first. You know, that's okay. I didn't go up again after that. It was two pork cobs and then back on the ale. It wasn't seven pork cobs or something ridiculous. But yeah, you send people up for you.
I'm imagining you now at a teacher training conference being the only person who turns up with all their kids, just so you can send them all up to the buffet.
But the worst thing is that they're all usually quite young ladies in primary school teaching. So you're there with some massive plate of food because you're starving. And then there's these girls with like half a samosa and stuff. You think, fucking hell, I look like a rot fat bastard.
You're doing them a favour though, Gary. Like you say, they don't want to be taking it all home.
I'm taking the bodyguard calories for them. I'm jumping in front of that shot. I'm doing it for them.
And that shot is samosa shaped.
The best kind.
That bullet is a bargee.
Get me body armour.